The following interview is Professor Eric Chaffetz on Zionism, genocide, and his conflict with Cornell. It features longtime Catholic worker peace activist Marianne Grady Flores in conversation with Cornell Professor Eric Chaffetz, a scholar specializing in the study of settler colonialism and genocide. They spoke in Ithaca, New York on November 8, 2025.
So, Eric, tell us about your background.
Okay. So, I come from a sort of socialist working class family. At the beginning, my dad was a labor organizer and my mom was a labor organizer. My dad was a communist in the 30s and spent some time in Russia. Came back and was turned off by the Stalin administration and became slowly what I would call a liberal, but held on to his progressive roots. So we were raised not to be ashamed at all of his communism. He was very open about that his whole life. He became a labor lawyer, a leading labor lawyer. But I garnered these socialist values. My Uncle Sam, my mother's brother, was a labor leader as well and led some really terrific strikes in the 30s. So I grew up with a left point of view. And I grew up with a, let's put it mildly, a skeptical attitude towards power and bullying. And that sort of carried on with my, the way I am.
Your life's work.
Yeah.
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in several neighborhoods. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, partially in a working class Jewish neighborhood where my grandparents lived. Uh-huh. Then we moved to Washington, D.C., and slowly but surely we became very bourgeois.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, my dad was very successful.
As a lawyer,
yeah. Yeah, very, okay. Very, very successful. And he had built up trust both by unions and companies. So he was a big-time labor negotiator. He did write a book in 47 before he became a lawyer in the 50s. He went late to law school, and he died at a very young age. He died when he was 45 years old in 1958. But he'd already, he had a big obituary in the New York Times. He'd already made a substantial name for himself as a labor negotiator. Since he was trusted both by unions and by companies, but he was very successful. He was also, for a time, Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer.
Oh, wow.
And we knew Jimmy quite well.
What was your father's name?
Edward Chaffetz.
Okay. Yeah. So people could look him up.
Yeah. And he wrote a book on collective bargaining, which I read again recently. And the last thing he said that if labor was not able to democratically participate in the workforce, that we would become a police state. And I think it's quite prophetic. He wrote this in 1947. So both he and my mom were very sharp. And I say we were well aware of their roots. So both my brother and I were influenced strongly by.
And mom's name?
Julia.
Julia.
Yeah, Chaffetz and then Cohen. She remarried after a few years after my dad died.
And she's passed.
She has.
Uh-huh, yeah. So, Eric, tell us more about your family, your kids, and where are they? And
so, I'm married to Darlene Evans, mm-hmm. Who's been my partner now for almost 35 years, and very instrumental in my life, both intellectually and emotionally, obviously.
Yes.
And we have a melded family. So Darlene's daughter, Jennifer, is the oldest. She's in New York City and manages a high-end boutique. And then I have three daughters. I have my daughter, Rachel's second in the age hierarchy, and she's an Israeli citizen. And we have three grandchildren in Israel. Then there's my daughter, Kara, and she's in Baltimore. She's starting out trying to find a new career, so she's back in college now. She was in real estate and got very tired of that, so she's exploring opportunities. And then our youngest daughter, Alana, who's a videographer, and she married a Scotsman and lives in Edinburgh.
I hadn't realized she'd gotten married. That's wonderful. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So
I remember her as a teenager.
Yeah, well, she's a very successful videographer.
That's great.
And she's glad to be out of the United States.
Yeah, at this moment in history, yeah.
So,
and tell us about your work in academia.
Right. Well, I come to academia I don't have a bachelor's degree. I was able to skip that process and go to graduate school. So I began graduate school in the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins. I was publishing poetry, and so they took me without the bachelor's degree. And then I went on from there to the comparative literature program for a PhD, where I developed an interest in American literature, and through my interest in American literature, necessarily developed an interest in Native America. And so I began to explore that quite deeply and develop an expertise in federal Indian law, which is what my last book is about. Did some expert testimony in that area. So beginning in grad school, there was nobody doing much work in Native America and American literature, very, very contradictorily enough, since this country is founded on stolen Indian land and stolen African labor. So I became interested in Native America. It kind of dawned on me that there was a big absence here. So that's became my, you know, my focus. And from that focus on indigenous peoples here, I developed an interest because of my Jewish roots. I am Jewish, and because I have ties to Israel, I became interested in Palestine and Israel and began to develop an expertise in that. And that, because of the situation in Israel, historically led me to genocide studies as well. So all of these components came together.
So tell us about your work having to do with genocide.
Mark Levine, who's I collaborate with, he's a Middle Eastern Studies scholar at the University of California at Irvine. And so we met at the Society for the Humanities at Cornell when we were both fellows there before I became a permanent member of the faculty. And so Mark actually asked me, he wanted to write something on genocide in Israel. And this was before Gaza. So we collaborated on a piece called Israel, Palestine, and the Poetics of Genocide. Our intent was to define genocide. And we began with the 1948 Convention, which is the standard international law on genocide. But that was generated at the end of the Second World War. And the paradigm for that convention was the Holocaust. And in the Holocaust, 63% of Jewry was wiped out by the Nazis. So the convention really depended, and depends, the 1948 convention, on scale and intent. And that narrows the definition in considerable ways, which I'll talk about. And, of course, that convention had to be ratified by the great powers. And what the great powers did not want to confront was the slower genocides in colonial countries, which they had colonized, and were still colonizing in 1948.
And to this day.
So that kept the convention very focused on the scale and intent. And Mark and I wrote about that, and we wrote that under that convention prior to Gaza, we wrote this article in 2017, and at that point, Israel, we argued, could not be convicted of genocide because they had not met these criteria of scale and intent. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Palestinian population was increasing. 7 million Palestinians in that, in what was Palestine, 7 million Jews actually as well. But we also pointed at that point that we needed a different definition of genocide to account for what people had called, genocide scholars had called, cold or incremental genocide. Mm-hmm. Alain Pape, the Israeli scholar, talks about incremental genocide in his books. And that is a genocide which does not necessarily entail a cataclysmic killing of the kind we saw in the Holocaust or in Rwanda, which is a classic genocide, but a slower kind of limiting the access to life-enforcing material commodities, and also to the ability to have sovereignty, to self-determine one's future. So in Israel, as everybody knows, we first of all have 20% of the Israel population is Arab, mostly Palestinian.
Within the 68 borders?
Yeah, within the 68, the Green Line, over the Green Line. And they are definitely second-class citizens. They can't buy land, first of all. And all of this, settler colonialism is about land, who gets the land. And Israel has now, I think, about 80% of the former Palestine.
Yep.
They've really, really moved in since before 1917, end of the 19th century, to take over what was Palestinian land.
Yeah, and they're on steroids right now, especially in the West Bank.
Right.
Since October 7th.
They are indeed. Yeah. And there's not much land left to take, actually, right. So that they haven't already taken. So we were looking, we broached a question in the first essay about a different scale of genocide, one that looked at what Patrick Wolfe calls, the Australian scholar who's now passed, in a very famous formative essay, Settler Colonialism and the Elimination of the Native, what he calls structural genocide, which encompasses a slower form of genocide in which the means of living and autonomy are really taken away from people. But it doesn't necessarily, although it may entail what he calls frontier homicide, which is a kind of cataclysmic genocide we're used to calling genocide. And then the Gaza war started, 2023, October 7th. So Marx said, well, we should update what we wrote because now a cataclysmic genocide is taking place in Gaza. So we came back to the drawing board, so to speak, and we published another essay in the Journal of Genocide Researchers, which is where the Patrick Wolfe essay was originally published. Settler colonialism was not talked about at all in academia. Colonialism was talked about.
But not settler.
No, usually, you know, classic colonialism, India is the example. Your country moves in and it does not take the land, does not settle a population from the mother country, but exploits the resources, human and material, of that particular country. And that was classic colonialism. But Wolfe came along and he said, look, there's another kind of colonialism going on here, the kind we have here in the United States, in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and that is settler colonialism, where the purpose is to take the land and displace the native population.
Which is what's happening in Palestine.
And I think the United States is a good example of that, because if you go to 1492 and you just think of the lower 48 states, which is called Indian country, by the way, legally and vernacularly, there were conservatively 5 to 6 million native people here in 1492 in what would become the lower 48 states. And that's conservative.
Yes.
I take my figures from a Cherokee demographer who's very, very highly thought of, Russell Thornton. By the end of the 19th century, there were 250,000 left. And that is a result both of frontier homicide and the kind of structural genocide that Patrick Wolfe speaks of, the deprivation from native people of the ways of living and being autonomous. So the distinction settler colonialism, colonialism is very important. You see the same operations in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada.
You know, as you spoke, and I was thinking about the point of the oppression of Israel upon especially Palestinians in the West Bank now, which is much less, it's not focused on in the West Bank. But just, I want to read something to you, and this is from TRT World. So illegal Israeli settlers carried out at least 264 attacks against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank during October, that's this month, marking the highest monthly total since officials began tracking the incidences in 2006, the UN said on November 7th. So just this month. And by the way, we are taping, and today's the 8th. In a statement warning against the sharp rise in violence, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, said the attacks, which resulted in casualties and property damage, amounted to an average of 8 incidents per day. And according to OCHA, more than 9,600 such attacks have been documented, with about 1,500 occurring this year alone, roughly 15% of the total. And the UN body added that according to the OCHA-confirmed data, 42 Palestinian children had been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank so far this year, meaning every five Palestinians killed has been a child. So that's just a little tiny piece. You were talking about the definition and the differentiation between colonialism and settler colonialism.
Right. Okay. Right. So the second article, which is the, and we call the Israel-Palestine and the Poetics of Genocide Revisited since the Gaza genocide, we talked about very, very focused on expanding the definition of genocide, even though now we can, South Africa's in the International Court of Justice using the standard genocide definition to indict Israel, even though we still think we need a more expanded definition of genocide to take in the colonial situation, structural genocide. I mean, there, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not the only one, the Native American genocide is continuing here. Native Americans remain the poorest of the poor, the most proportionally the most incarcerated, proportionally the most affected by bad health, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is a definition of structural genocide because they are being kept, deprived of, quite consciously, through federal Indian law, quite consciously of their own autonomy, their own sovereignty, their own access to the means of a decent living. It also manifests itself here, you know, the frontier homicide came to an end in the United States in the 1890s with the Battle at Wounded Knee, which was the last massacre of Native people by the U.S. government. But it continued through the boarding schools, the forced assimilation of Native children and the attempt to deculturate them. And it continued through the sterilization of Native women against their knowledge. When they would come into the health service, they would be sterilized. It continues in the disappearance of thousands of Native women, both here and in Canada, which the federal government, who has the responsibility of pursuing these cases, does not pursue. And that is under federal Indian law. The Indian communities themselves do not have the right to prosecute federal crimes. In all of these ways, a structural genocide is continuing. Hence our desire to expand the definition and use the Patrick Wolf definition. The essay is online, the journal is online, and we've gotten, Mark tells me, over 7,000 hits.
That's fantastic.
On the essay so far. And I know that he had told me that Francesca Albanese had wanted to see the article.
So, Eric, tell us, what is it about Zionism that leads to genocide in Gaza?
Well, I think the place to start, there are two places to start. One of the books that I taught in my course, Gaza Indigeneity and Resistance, which got some controversy. I guess we can talk about that a little later, maybe.
Yeah.
Was Theodor Herzl's The Jewish State, which is sort of the Bible, published in 1896, the Bible of Zionism. And one of the ironies is, of course, Zionism begins because of anti-Semitism. It's a reaction to anti-Semitism. That's quite clear. But at the same time, Herzl says in his text that Zionism will become an outpost for Western colonialism against the barbarism of, i.e., the Palestinians. Right, so there's a contradiction to begin with. The Jews were a heavily colonized people prior to moving into Palestine, and yet they themselves propagated a form of colonialism. I think understanding what's going on in Israel, that contradiction has to be thought of. The Jews underwent a Holocaust, a terrible genocide, paradigmatic actually for all Western genocides. And yet they are perpetrating a genocide in Palestine. And I think that for many Jews, this is very troubling, certainly troubling for myself and many of my contemporaries. And I also think for a younger generation of Jewish people who are turning away from Israel, the latest polls here in the United States show that there is really a disengagement from Israel for younger Jews. And I can understand why. So Zionism begins with that contradiction. And then I think a really formative article, which I also taught, which I think everybody needs to read, is Zev Jabotinsky's The Iron Wall, which he wrote in 1923. He was a very prominent Zionist activist and scholar, and he wrote a short essay called The Iron Wall, and it was addressed to moderates, Jews, who thought we could have a peaceful coexistence with Palestinians, even though they wanted a majority Jewish state. So there's a real contradiction here. Martin Buber is a good example of this, the great Jewish philosopher. And Buber wanted a binational state, but at the same time, he argued that the Jews had primacy, a religious primacy, spiritual primacy in Palestine, that they were closer to the land than the Palestinians. So he's caught in a contradiction too. So I think this was sort of the moderate position. And Jabotinsky says quite openly in this article, which he addresses to them, moderation will not work here. We are going to be resisted by the Palestinians. He was quite right about that. He compared them, though, to Native Americans as primitives and talked about Jewish superiority, mm-hmm. Zionist superiority. But he says we will not be able to live peacefully with them. They will resist us. So we need an iron wall against them, a militarized approach to this. We cannot use a peaceful approach. So that was what was adopted. He won that argument. And so this, in succeeding generations, you see that militarized approach operating. The 67 war is a great example of this. But all the wars that Israel has fought with either the Arabs or internally the way they've dealt with the Palestinians, the militarization of Israel proper until 1964, over and against the Arabs, then the lifting of that militarization, but the West Bank is totally militarized. In fact, I've compared it to Native America in the 19th century. What you have, and Rashid Khalidi has used this phrase, is an archipelago of prisons. That's essentially what you've got, Bantustans. And Gaza, of course, has been called the largest outdoor prison in the world.
I would say concentration camp.
Yes,
not prison, because in prisons you can get visits. Concentration camps, you can't get visits.
Right, I think that's good.
So the other thing that I was thinking we should help our audience understand is the use of the word Arab versus Palestinians.
Right.
I think the people that live there want to be distinguished as Palestinians.
Yes, they do.
Right, yeah, okay.
Of course, that's been a big controversy because, as you know, Golda Meir said there's no such thing as the Palestinian people.
So I don't know whether it's important that I bring this up, but I have two friends. I mean, they're in, well, the one person, Sarah Pines, who lives up at Kendall, she brought her Palestine passport. She was born in Palestine. She's a Jewish woman. We saw it, you know, there it says, Palestine, right on the cover.
When was it issued?
She's in her 90s now, so I don't know.
Yeah, so the question would be, although, again, I don't have an answer for this, it was a British mandate from 1917 till the British gave it up to the UN in 47. So I would assume you would get, but maybe they issued Palestinian passports instead of British passports. Yeah, so Jabotinsky's Zionism was both militarized and increasingly racist. I mean, he begins by saying these people, the Palestinians, although they are resistors, are inferior to Jews.
And didn't he specifically say something about them being the indigenous people?
Yes.
And that they will struggle against us, the quote-unquote settlers?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Something that Israelis now deny.
Yes.
That the Palestinians are the indigenous people and that Israelis are settlers. But he was very explicit about it, and nobody seemed to contradict him at that moment.
Right.
Now they've gotten this mythological narrative. This is true of all settler colonial societies. They have a mythological origin narrative, which gives them primacy, even though it denies the historical realities. In fact, at the time when Zionists started to come into Palestine, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, there were about 10,000 Jews living in
Palestine. Out of a population of what?
600,000 Palestinians.
Okay. And they were fully recognized and incorporated within the society.
There was some tension. I mean, the extent of that tension between Jews and Palestinians, I have not explored. Other people have.
I have a little quick narrative. My friend Issa Amro, who just won an award with Time Magazine, I think, when we went to an I Have a Dream protest on Shuhada Street in Hebron, he told that story to all of us that were there with the folks breaking the silence, which were the soldiers telling on themselves as to what the crimes were that they were committing against Palestinians. He said, "My grandfather and his fellow shop owner, my grandfather was Muslim, Palestinian Muslim, and the shop owner was Palestinian Jewish. They shared ownership of the shop. One guy would go to the mosque on Friday, the other person would go to temple on Saturday. And it was cooperative. It was not adversarial at all."
Yeah, I'm sure there was cooperation going on. There was probably some tension as well. But the population discrepancy was clearly on the Palestinian end of things. But that clearly began to change with, you know, the influx of Zionists at the end of the 19th century. The mantra of Zionism was a land without a people for a people without a land. So already Zionism had built into it the notion that there were no Palestinian people. And it's exactly the same outlook that the U.S. had or Americans had toward Native Americans. They were just part of the landscape. They weren't really an existing civilization. And this is part of settler colonial myths of origin. So a deconstruction of these myths is in another book I taught by the Israeli scholar Shlomo Sand, The Invention of the Jewish People.
Say the first name again.
Shlomo. Sand.
Sand, okay.
The Invention of the Jewish People, in which he points out that the myth of the chosen people, which is what the Israelis displaced the actual history with, is a myth. There is almost no historic evidence for the kingdoms of David, Saul, and Solomon. There's very little archaeological evidence of a Jewish presence in the Holy Land, although Jews were certainly there, and there were revolts of Jews against various rulers. But the mythological story that the Jews had these great kingdoms, which were then, you know, fallen and displaced, et cetera, is basically narratives coming out of the Bible. They're stories. And they're part of the origin myth of Israelis claiming primacy in this land, when, in fact, there's tremendous historical evidence that the Palestinians were there historically up until the present moment.
That's right. And the DNA evidence as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So you have these settler colonial myths. You have the myth here of the chosen people as well. The Puritans came over believing that God had given them this land in which they could spread Puritanism, their form of Protestantism. And then that turns into a more secular version called Manifest Destiny, that this is our God-given land and we have the right to spread democracy around the world, you know, a sort of euphemism for imperialism. So these myths are constitutive of settler colonialism.
I wanted to go back to the point of Theodor Herzl being a non-believing Jew, and many of those that gathered to, you know, figure out how the Zionist state would be established and all that was done by people that were not necessarily practicing Jews.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, it's a secular state. It's not a religious state per se, although the Orthodox have a tremendous amount of power in Israel now, manifested in the whole draft issue that goes on about not drafting ultra-Orthodox kids because they're studying the Torah. But yeah, Zionism is quite a secular operation. If you read the Jewish state, it's about setting up a state there. It doesn't talk about religion and to any degree whatsoever, really.
And that book was written by Herzl. And so the trajectory of Zionism leading to genocide, mm-hmm. Do you want to expound on that a little bit more as to what's going on today in Gaza? Going back to Jabotinsky?
Well, as I said, his ideology is both racist and militarist, and those are the seeds of genocide. And the notion that there should be a Jewish majority, it had to be a Jewish majority state, also leads to the fact when you're dealing with 600,000 Palestinians that you're going to have to ethnically cleanse the state.
Right.
So I think when you put all those components together, that ideology is Zionism. It is racist, it is militarist, and it portends ethnic cleansing mm-hmm. because of the necessity for having a Jewish majority. And so ultimately, this is what we get to. You know, settler colonial states go to Australia, go to New Zealand, United States, are genocidal.
What you said about, you know, the militarism and the racism, it reminds me of Martin Luther King's triad, where he says it's consumerism or capitalism, which drives Israel, I mean, the state of Israel and its society, and also the racism and the militarism. Okay, so tell us the context in which Cornell targeted you and your course on Gaza leading to your forced retirement. And how recently did all that happen?
Well, it starts in 2024. It really starts right after the October 7th. When Hamas invaded Israel briefly. And I think, you know, what was going on in the United States is very important under both the Biden administration and now under the Trump administration, which was this need to uphold our relationship with Israel no matter what. And even when we saw genocide coming and when the law told us we should stop sending weapons to Israel, et cetera, we kept on. And then we started, in order to uphold that position, to demonize people who are critical of it. So I think that that's the overall context. So I think, you know, we have to look also at the position of universities in this, because what started to happen then is anti-Semitism got weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
And it crossed or added to the historic definition, which is simply a hatred of Jews for being Jews, and Jewish institutions for being Jewish, it became politicized so that now critiques of Zionism and critiques of Israel became anti-Semitic. And the government is responsible for this. The Biden government started it with congressional hearings, which called the presidents of Harvard, Penn, and MIT to task for not being hard enough on anti-Semitism. That definition was never specified. mm-hmm. but it implicitly included then anything that attacked Israel or was critical of Zionism. And these presidents unfortunately folded.
What was going on the campuses that manifested the idea that there was anti-Semitism within that academia?
Students began to protest what mm-hmm. was going on in Gaza, Israel's increasing movement towards a genocide. And so those protests had to be demonized as well. And so you have Columbia's, the prime example here. The university's calling in the police to put down protests that were essentially...
Gaza peace encampments.
Yeah.
That sprung up across the country.
They were essentially peaceful. The violence came from the university, the police side, but it was then projected onto the peaceful protesters, which is a phenomenon we often see in this kind of activity.
So because I was up at the Cornell peace encampment almost every day, I would have conversations with the police. And ironically, our Cornell police, CUPD, as they say, they called this particular encampment the monastery because it was so peaceful.
Yeah, it was very peaceful.
Yeah.
And it was a peaceful encampment to the point where Cornell then wanted to shut it down, and they shut it down. But there was no violence of the kind that we saw at Columbia or UCLA, for example, where the police were called in. So yeah. Cornell showed restraint in that respect.
I want to make another footnote. The attacks on the peaceful protesters at UCLA, the calls to the police went unheard for 4 hours. And what was going on was there were these drones brought in, and only because I have been watching the Instagram live feed from Gaza did I know about these particular drones that were being used, which would put a tape on with women and children screaming, calling for help. Those were being used in Gaza. And people would come running out of their homes to see who needed help. And then the drones would assassinate them, you know, just murder them right there in the streets. That same tape was being used above the UCLA peace encampment. Mm-hmm. And I strongly suspect that many of the young people that may have dual citizenship, Israelis that had been called up to serve in Gaza, were the ones that came in and were beating the peaceful protesters with steel bats and everything else. Mm-hmm. And why was it that the LAPD was told to stand down for 4 hours? It wasn't just the police. It was, in my observation and putting two and two together, nobody else would know about those drone things unless they had been in Gaza using those drones.
This is the context, the genocide in Gaza, the need to justify it, rationalize it by the federal government, and so the demonization of people who are opposed to it. And since universities have always been sort of centers of protest historically, the 60s, what have you, the focus was put on the universities where courses were being taught advocating for Palestinians, or at least giving Palestinian history, recognizing them as sovereign people or people that should be sovereign. And you get this demonization of quote-unquote pro-Palestinian academic students, staff, and sanctions started to be applied. Molina was mentioned, former Vice President Molina of Communications at Cornell, who addressing 200 parents or so at Hillel and at Cornell, talked about the active surveillance of professors. In fact, he cited two professors and specifically doxed them, basically called them out in front of these parents at Hillel, and that we would be surveilling these people. There was a call for divestment. Look, Cornell has been tied up with Israel intimately since the Technion connection. Cornell is partners with Technion in Israel, and Technion in Israel is central in developing arms, weaponry, the wall that separates the West Bank from Israel proper. So that connection has been strong, and Cornell is invested in it. Donors and trustees are invested in it.
And
so
all
there
the
was
weapons companies.
A definite impetus coming out of that to suppress anti-Israeli talk critical of Israel's genocide.
So tell us a little bit more of what happened to the students and then go to your case, if I may bring you around.
Yeah, these expressive activity policies were developed by the administration. And one should say that historically, faculty governance has been increasingly subverted over the years. In fact, we were talking to Margaret Washington after dinner yesterday, and one of the things she pointed out is that administrators used to come out of the faculty mm-hmm. and go back into the faculty. So there was a sense of responsibility toward your colleagues. But now there's a professional class of administrators who have nothing to do with the faculty and have decided to make careers out of being administrators. So instead of deans coming back into their departments, they go on to be provost someplace else or dean someplace else. And this has created a real crisis in faculty governance, which has been increasingly undercut. According to the bylaws of Cornell University, the faculty, and I was in the Senate for 7 years, the faculty is supposed to have a say over educational policy. We just signed an agreement with the Trump administration. The faculty had no say whatsoever in that agreement, and it is totally about educational policy. So what you see taking place is a total disconnect between administrators, faculty, students, and staff. And administrators now tend to talk only to trustees and donors, not to recognize their basic constituency. This has led to an increasingly oppressive atmosphere at universities. They've become autocracies. They were never, I suppose, democracies in the fullest sense, but they were certainly partially democracies. Mm-hmm. And they had a democratic strain running through them where faculty and students, you know, were active and could be listened to. And I think this has gone out. I gave the example when I was at Georgetown, my first job, which was then a Jesuit university. It's become more secular since then. That during the apartheid days of South Africa, the students put out a big encampment all over campus, and the Jesuits did not touch that encampment. They let it exist. And then a year or two later, the Pope called them and said, divest.
The power of the Pope. Oh, my God.
You know, I was there. There was, whether it was right-wing Jesuits or left-wing Jesuits who were down in Latin America at that point under liberation theology, they had an ethical core. There's no ethical core in universities anymore.
None.
It's money.
It's corporations.
Yeah, they become totally corporate. That's been part of my scholarship for a long time. I wrote an essay that was published in 2000 called The End of Academia, which looked at the decline in tenured jobs. That's the other thing. Only 23% of universities now are fully tenured, 9% on tenure track. That has completely undermined faculty, because without the protections of tenure, even though those have become weaker,
People have no security at all,
which, of course, makes people very wary of speaking out, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look, I wrote a piece on this in Counterpunch called The Collapse of the Corporate University in the Time of Gaza. If you look at the 9% tenure track, there's not going to be tenure will come to an end. It will come to an end. And then if universities aren't strongly unionized, people will be totally at the prey of administrations. That seems to be what the future looks like, and we're getting a taste of that now. So the administration came up with these very draconian expressive activity policies, which allowed them, without due process, to suspend students from classes or from campus without a hearing.
And name two of the more famous
students. Mamadou Tal is one, and Amandla
Thomas Johnson.
Yeah.
So Mamadou is from Gambia. And Amandla is Senegalese and Trinidadian. But both of them grew up in London. So they laugh and they speak very quickly. And they're hysterical to be with. They're wonderful, but so principled. And those two were targeted by Cornell University.
Right. Yeah. I know. I actually knew neither of them. I'm sure our paths, I'm sure, crossed in protests and one thing or another. But anyway, students were subjected to these very draconian policies. October 27th, 2023, so this is just...
Days after.
Yeah. I gave a teach-in on Gaza, which became the basis of the course, Gaza Indigeneity and Resistance. And it, you know, was very peaceful, as these things tend to be. What's interesting is Kotlikoff, who is now president of Cornell, was provost then, and he called me up, and he didn't criticize the teach-in at all. He just said, do you want security?
I said,
I don't think I really need it, but, you know, if we have one campus policeman there, that would certainly do the trick if there's any issues. And there weren't any. So this was the basis of my Gaza Indigeneity Resistance course. Then, when I proposed the course in 2024...
Spring semester?
It was going to be taught in the spring semester of 2025. So I proposed it in the fall of 2024. And he was then interim president. He got a complaint from an adjunct professor in the law school named Menachem Rosenzweig. They had read, as far as I can tell, because I hadn't taught the course yet, they had seen a two-sentence description of the course. Uh-huh. And suddenly Rosenzweig went haywire about, you know, this was a pro-Hamas course, blah, 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 and needed to be shut down. And he called Kotlikoff and talked about it. And Kotlikoff concurred with his opinions based on a two-semester, neither of them being an expert in indigenous studies. Rosenzweig writes on genocide, I guess, and is the child of survivors of the Holocaust. And I'm a Zionist, clearly. So they didn't get in touch with me, which would have been the collegial thing to do, and, you know, sat down with me and said, what are you going to be teaching? And I would have told them. Rosenzweig went off to the Jewish press, to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and, you know, started condemning the course there and quoting Kotlikoff, who never told him, look, I don't want this to be public because it violates academic freedom if the president of a university begins to criticize courses that have been passed, as this was, by a faculty committee constituted precisely to do that job. And it was the CALS Curriculum Committee, on which I had served previously, which passed the course. So Kotlikoff was violating academic freedom in the first place. And he received at that point a letter, a public letter of condemnation from the Middle Eastern Studies Association, which testified to the fact that I am an expert in the field and that he had no right, in fact, was violating academic freedom. The local AAUP weighed in, et cetera, et cetera.
Say that. What is AAUP?
American Association of University Professors.
Got it.
So that was the beginning. I taught the course in spring of 2025. And at a certain point, this graduate student from computer science, who was Israeli, he told me that. I never ask my students their identity. Sometimes they give their identity in talking about their personal experiences. And I teach a significant number of indigenous students who take my courses. So this Israeli guy came, and he initially asked me if he could take the course. And I asked him why he wanted to take it, and he spoke about it. Well, first of all, he lied. He said he needed to take an undergraduate courses as a computer science graduate student, which I knew was not true. But at first I welcomed him, and I kind of thought, okay, well, having an Israeli voice in the class, if it's a responsible voice, would be good. And so he came, and he turned out to be completely disruptive. My students, in a letter to the Sun, have fully explicated the kind of disruption that he caused.
So tell us what the Sun is for the broader audience.
Yeah, the Sun is the Cornell Daily Sun, which is a campus newspaper. And towards the end of this controversy, when I had been forced into retirement by Cornell, my students wrote I got a lot of support. There was a resolution in the Faculty Senate signed by 200 faculty members that condemned the university for the way it acted in the process of this course, and I will go over that process a little more specifically. But during that time, my students wrote in a letter which talked how they felt that he had come to dox them. The Israeli student had come for that purpose. And my only Palestinian student quit the course after the first day. She was so threatened by his presence. So given that reaction by my students and the fact that it seemed to me at times he was recording the course, he had his phone out. My students did, after the first class, actually, when he was there, came to me with their worries that they felt threatened. So after the third course, when he had really seemed to be recording things, I called him aside into my office, and we had a discussion, which he taped. It turns out he was a surveillance expert for the IDF. So he was taping me. I didn't know he was taping me. And we had a discussion. At the end of the discussion, to make a long story short, in any event, I asked him if he would just leave the course because he was clearly there for ulterior motives. Mm. He was not doing the reading.
Oh.
He was not engaged in any productive way with what the students were trying to discuss because they were very focused on the reading. And my courses actually demand that you do the readings, that you come prepared to talk about them. And students are very good about that and makes for a good discussion. But he had not done the reading, so he was just pushing back when he talked against them from an Israeli point of view. So it was a non-productive engagement, and they were worried about the doxing. they also brought those worries to my student services specialist, who was aware of them as well.
Yeah, say what doxing is, because that's a term that's recent and it's used in academia, but for the layperson out in the...
Yeah, well, doxing is bringing to attention the names of people who have been engaged, in this case, in pro-Palestinian activism or in even discussing Palestine from a positive point of view, so they can potentially come under sanctions of one kind or another in this atmosphere in which universities are being oppressive. Along with the exposure of names, it makes them vulnerable to the academic hierarchy, to employers, and to people who want to harass them. Because what comes out, clearly, once you give somebody's name, you can look up their address, you can find their phone number, and that exposes them to maleficent activities.
And then the people are afraid, well, many times are prevented from being hired and...
That can happen, yeah. So I think it's particularly happened in law schools, where law firms have refused to entertain any applications of students who have been doxed in this manner.
Yeah, this is sick business.
Yeah.
All right, so he taped you, and say what the particulars were, that he would start a sentence and then not finish it?
He did not want to, and this comes out in the long haul, he actually was very protective of his own identity. So he didn't want to make any statements that would sort of give him away. So he would start sentences, and then he would just stop.
And this is all in the context of that meeting that you had in your office.
Yes.
With him.
Yeah, yeah. Looks like I'm constantly interrupting him. But I was not interrupting him. He was just not talking. He did not let that tape out of his hands. He would only allow a transcript of the tape. And in the transcript of the tape, it can look like I'm just interrupting him, not letting him speak. Whereas if you heard the tape, you could hear the pauses that he was not finishing sentences. Of course, he could have doctored the tape so you couldn't have heard that too, but he didn't let the tape out of his hands. And there was no insistence from the administration that he give up the tape if he wanted to make an accusation. So anyway, I asked him to leave. In fact, he could have said to me at this point, and I emphasize this, he could have said, look, I'll do the reading. I will interact more productively with the students. I'd like to take the course, in which case I would have said, okay. I called him in after class. He had already told me he was Israeli anyway. I did not know he was a surveillance expert. As I said, I don't ask my students their identity. Sometimes they give it up, and he had given me his identity way prior.
As an Israeli.
As an Israeli,
but
period.
Not as a surveillance expert.
He had not told me. This was uncovered by the reporter for The Nation. Actually, my lawyers uncovered it, but we did not use it in any of our the hearings that took place. And it finally came out because Gabe Levin, who wrote the Nation articles and a former editor of the Daily Sun.
The Cornell Daily Sun.
And one of my students, a former student of mine, he brought it out in his investigative recording. That's how we know he was part of Unit 8200, which is a special surveillance unit within the IDF.
Oh, my God.
That's where we found out. We were very strict about keeping confidentiality, because you can get accused of retaliation by bringing out. In other words, we did not want to dox this person. So we constantly referred to him in the testimony that followed as a graduate student, period, paragraph. That's how we talked about him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did ask him to leave the class after we had discussed his perspective and the fact he was pushing a perspective and not participating in the requirements of the class, and he was upsetting the students.
And he wasn't doing the reading.
I said he wasn't participating in the requirements. And he left the discussion we had. He said he had to go somewhere. I think he was probably becoming very uncomfortable at that point. And he left. And then 3 months later, he filed a complaint with what is now the Office of Civil Rights. It was the Title IX office and the Office of Institutional Equity, but Cornell has changed it to the Office of Civil Rights. So that's what it's called now. He filed a complaint that I had pushed him out of the class because he was Israeli, and that violates a Title VI requirement of national identity, that you don't discriminate against anyone because of national identity. And so we had an investigative hearing from the Civil Rights Office, and they found that, yes, I was guilty of that, but they also said they understood my position, mm-hmm. and they did not impose any sanction. They passed it on to the Dean of Arts and Sciences, Peter Lowen, and they told him to talk to me about the situation and come to some agreement, I guess, on sanctions, if there were going to be sanctions. The dean never called me.
Oh.
And then he imposed a sanction of 2 semesters without pay, which is the harshest sanction you can impose short of dismissal. So at that point...
With no discussion.
There was no. He never called me, which they had suggested. And he never obviously took into account that my position was understandable and that they also said they had struggled to come up with a decision, the decision which, with which they came up. Okay, so he just went and got the most draconian. This is like what they do to the students. It's a parallel to that whole process. Just imposing the harshest sanction you can think of without ever talking to the people or having a proper hearing. Well, in fact, we had had a proper hearing. They did an investigative report, and they said my position was understandable, even though they felt I had asked him to leave because of his identity. At that point, also, there were no student testimonies, because when they asked me in the investigation if I wanted to get some student input for the hearing, I said I didn't want to involve my students in this. I was still teaching the course, and I just didn't want them involved.
But then, it's an awkward position.
So at that moment, when he imposed those sanctions, I got a lawyer, because we had to appeal that if we wanted to go forward and not accept the sanctions, which we did not want to do. We had to appeal that with the Academic Freedom Committee, which is a Senate-appointed committee which has the purview of hearing these cases. That is a bylaw of Cornell University. And the decision of that committee, I quote the language, must be accepted by the deans, et cetera.
And the president of the university.
So we went to the Academic Freedom Committee.
And who are the members in that committee?
I don't know the names of the members.
But are they faculty?
Yes,
They're all
faculty.
Okay.
Faculty committee appointed by the faculty senate.
Okay.
With the power to hear these cases. And there were 7 of them. And the chair of the committee doesn't vote. So we went to the committee with my lawyer, and we got a unanimous vote in favor of me, that I had not violated Title VI, okay, and that they said no sanctions were warranted. Let me quote from the Academic Freedom Committee's statement about my situation. The committee determined that the comments related to national origin in the transcript of the student's recording of the January 30th conversations alone do not provide sufficient grounding to show by clear and convincing evidence that Professor Chaffetz encouraged the graduate student to drop the course because of the student's national origin. And that should have been the end of that,
right,
according to policy. The bar was clear and convincing evidence. They had to prove by clear and convincing evidence. And they didn't reach that bar.
The administration.
Yeah, and that's what I remember the Academic Freedom Committee. It's not a long report. The Academic Freedom Committee found that it was not his Israeli identity, that was not the reason I asked him to leave the class. It was because he was a disruptive presence. They don't even say that in the report, but it's implicit in everything, because that's the evidence we were presenting. Luna Drewby, my lawyer, was presenting evidence that, in fact, although the word Israeli came up, and on the tape I tell him he's Israeli and he's pressing an Israeli point of view, that was political. It was not about his identity, that he was pressing a point of view in a way outside the context of really engaging with the students. I mean, it was just pushback. It was not an engagement based on the reading and what it was supposed to be. So I think from my perspective, that was all implicit in her. That was what she argued. But when you read the report, what you see is they just voted unanimously that I had not asked him to leave because of his identity.
And this is, the vote was done by the committee of 7, and the one leader doesn't vote.
Yeah, so 6-0.
Got it. Okay.
In my favor.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And no sanctions were warranted.
And then what happened
and
after?
The language is clear that the dean must accept this verdict. What happened was the administration overturned it, set it aside, because they wanted a conviction. So they concocted this alternative hearing process that I had to go through. And at the end of that process would be Kotlikoff, who got the final decision, no matter what the new hearing decided.
And Kotlikoff is the president now.
He is the president of the university, and he was clearly biased against me. That's in the record in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency quotes, et cetera, et cetera. in addition to opening up a new hearing, which is in effect double jeopardy, they also canceled my classes, which is a violation of policy as well. And they were apprised of this violation and the other violations which occurred in them overturning the Academic Freedom Committee by a letter from the National Organization of the American Association of University Professors. So that's where we stood. And Cornell came across with no settlement offers. And so we were prepared to go through that hearing process. And then we were prepared, if things turned out a certain way, and I can explain that, to go to court to sue Cornell. Because the one basis for suing a university is for employment discrimination, which is what this is, and what Luna's expertise is in, among other things, civil rights, employment discrimination, is if they violate consistently their own policies in sanctioning you. And Cornell had been violating consistently its own policies. Now, we would have had, from the new hearing, all right, which consisted of 5 faculty members, 2 picked by me, 2 picked by the administration, and then a chair picked by the 4, we would have had to have won that hearing, and then Kotlikoff would have had to contradicted that verdict. We couldn't be sure of that, obviously. So if we didn't win that hearing, in other words, if they had come up with a 3-2 vote against me, right, well, then a court of law could have said, look, you lost in this hearing process. So what do you, there's no complaint here. So that was the position we were in. Meanwhile, publicity was being generated in my favor. The Nation articles, the faculty resolution in my favor, letters to the editor, and Cornell was becoming exposed in terms of publicity to adverse publicity, and they came to the table finally and said, look, here's a settlement offer. We all on the team, Darlene, Tala, Luna, and Risa, sat down and looked at the offer, and it was an acceptable offer to settle, and the advice from everybody was to settle because we couldn't be sure of the outcome of further hearings, not to mention the money and legal costs and the time expended. We were all getting pretty sick and tired of fighting this oppressive administration.
So tell us what the outcome was, but also tell us who this team was. Who is Luna?
Okay, so the team was Darlene, my wife, a former faculty member at Cornell, emerita now, who, you know, all of us had significant input into the letters written to the university, to the pushback we presented, et cetera, et cetera. Risa Lieberwitz, who is a professor in the International School of ILR.
Industrial Labor Relations.
Yeah. And also a lawyer. She was the former counsel for the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors. Luna Drewby, who is a very, very famous civil rights lawyer out of New York. Beldock, Hoffman, and Levine is the firm. And her colleague, Tala Al-Fokaha, is Palestinian, just out of Harvard Law School, an associate. Luna's a partner in the firm, and Tala was an associate of the firm. The 5 of us were the team
okay,
that made all of these decisions, did all of the pushback, wrote letters, et cetera. And so that was the team. Cornell came to the table then, and I think because of all the bad publicity they were getting, and made under the circumstances, I always say, all things being unequal, they made an offer that was acceptable, which allows me retirement when I wanted to retire in June of 2026. Meanwhile, I am effectively on paid leave.
Okay.
They would not let me back in the classroom, but I'm on paid leave, and I'm considered a functionally retired faculty member, so I have access to students and faculty. I just can't give grades.
So you haven't been sanctioned from going on to campus, and you are are allowed to be in others' classrooms teaching the course.
As a guest lecturer, which I've done in 2 classes already.
That's great, and you've also presented in the People's University.
Yeah. There was no non-disclosure agreement. And I think there was no non-disclosure agreement even offered because at that point everything had been disclosed. And I think we can give Gabe Levin, my former student, former editor of the Daily Sun, and a professional journalist himself, credit for those Nation articles.
At the Nation, yeah.
Which brought everything out into the open. So I'm not saying anything here that hasn't been said.
Wow, what a story. This is very helpful to clarify. One of the things that Mamadou Tal said in a recent conference out of Detroit was, he said, in the sanctions that the university imposed on him, it was like he was living under occupation in that he wasn't allowed on campus. He was only allowed certain times. So it was the same kind of living situation that the Palestinians survived through in the West Bank. He wasn't allowed to get to the mosque for prayer, being a devout Muslim, except, you know, certain hours. He wasn't allowed to go in to teach his classes and so on. He had to have a mandla teach on his behalf. So thank God you do still have academic freedom in a certain sense, not that you're...
Well, I couldn't teach.
Right, that's huge. That is huge. And how many years have you been teaching?
Well, I've been at Cornell 22, altogether for about 45 years. What I had planned was to finish off the year teaching and retire. So everything is according to Hoyle, so to speak, except I can't teach formally. So I've been invited to teach. I have taught in two classes, and I miss the engagement, the steady engagement with students. There are things I don't miss, like grading papers and the bureaucratic nonsense that the Cornell increasingly imposes on faculty members, but I really miss the students who, it's a very energizing experience teaching and having conversations with people who are coming up in the world.
Yes, absolutely. Well, young people are so energizing. I absolutely am thrilled to be with them myself when I do go up for different events or to go in front of Day Hall every Thursday,
right,
where we protest and do the litany of the names of the dead from this Israeli-imposed genocide on Palestine. Anyway, Eric, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this was a gift.